The easiest way to secure and accelerate your website is with Encapsula, protecting over 4 million sites, from individual bloggers to the Fortune 50. Visit encapsula.com/packetpushers and use promo code DATANAUTS to get a 30-day free trial. This week's DataNauts podcast is sponsored in part by Interop ITX, the only independent conference for technology leaders. Get a year's worth of objective IT education in 1 week. Visit interopitx.com and use promo code PacketPushers for a 20% discount. Today on DataNauts, the harsh realities of scaling out. We check in with infrastructure operations at Sauce Labs and discuss just how hard it is to service an airplane in flight. I am Ethan Banks. You can follow me at EC Banks. Chris Wall is here, still wiping clay from his face after a relaxing visit to an Icelandic geothermal spa. You can follow his digital misadventures on Twitter at Chris Wall. And this is the DataNauts podcast. You can find this in all of our shows on iTunes, in your favorite podcatcher, or at packetpushers.net. Our guest today is Josh O'Brien. Josh and I have known each other for many years now. We've worked together. We've attended Tech Field Days together. We've both been bloggers of some notoriety out there in the world. And Josh, you're at Sauce Labs right now. So would you describe a little bit about what you're doing at Sauce and then maybe who Sauce Labs is?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with who Sauce Labs is. We are a platform that enables the CI/CD kind of space, so the continuous integration and continuous delivery methodologies. What we do is we actually host everything from Windows boxes to Ubuntu boxes to Mac, and even all the way down into real devices, so iPhones and Android phones. We provide those with a test framework. The two test frameworks we work with are two open source platforms called Appium and Selenium. Appium for the phone side and Selenium for the PC and browser side. What those do is those just provide giant grids of compute infrastructure and testable browsers and testable platforms for your web applications and your actual apps on phones.
You're like, someone's building an app and they need to test that app. They go to you guys and say, give me some infrastructure so that I can load my app on something and test. And you cover all of these different platforms.
Absolutely. And we have in just whole ranges of them that you can find on the website at saucelabs.com. But that's in a nutshell what we do. And we're always trying to keep up with the newest browsers and newest OSs and provide more and more. For Selenium, it's actually called something called Selenium Grid. And we just publicly host a Selenium Grid and then give people access to that as opposed to people having to spend thousands or millions of dollars building out their own framework to actually test against.
Now that I've got the Icelandic mud off my face or whatever Ethan was babbling on about, Josh, what do you do there? Like, what is your role at Sauce Labs?
I joined at the end of January last year. And when I first came on board, they were going through kind of an ops renaissance, trying to figure out what the right mode was. And I originally came on as the director of network operations. That's kind of my background. For those who don't know me, I've spent most of my career working in the network field and on switches and routers and firewalls and that good stuff. So we were having a lot of actual issues just keeping the network up and understanding what the black box of the network that Sauce Labs at the time had was. So they brought me in to kind of unpack that and make it not a black box and make it stable, which is pretty typical coming into environments that haven't had enterprise or scale out networking folks before. Pretty quickly after that, we stabilized things. We got the operations group working and they decided to move me to the senior director of operations. So now I'm responsible for all of our data center management and our data center teams, which is the rack and stack and physical work folks. They're actually more than that for us, but that's the general basis. The systems folks who handle all of our operating systems from a delivery perspective, as far as turning the OSs up, automation, making those available for the actual application platform. And then, of course, the network team, which is, you know, layer 2 all the way through 7, depending on what you're doing and when you're doing it. But I've got a handful of those guys, too, who are handling at our data center and our WAN and our backbone operations.
So when you walked in the door, what were the biggest challenges that you were facing? Or in other words, what's the pile of crap that was handed to you? That's not too harsh.
No, that's legit. So I'm going to put a caveat on this before I start, because a lot of the stuff's going to be kind of negative. But the reality is, in any business, you kind of start someplace and you just grow over time. And some of the things you get to aren't necessarily because people were dumb or because people didn't know what they were doing, but things just kind of grow organically and they end up being kind of a mess. And at some point, in order to go to the next level, whether it's stability or scale or whatever you want to call it, you have to make some serious changes. So I actually was engaged by one of my people on Twitter who I've engaged with for years, who actually worked at SOS. Him and I have gone back and forth for years that networking sucks. And I've told him networking doesn't have to suck. He didn't believe me. So when their networking really kind of fell down around their ears around this time last year, he reached out to me and said, come help. So that's where this all started. Getting in the door in late January of last year, what we had is an enterprise stack of Juniper EX devices that were then stacked across multiple data centers. So across our POP, across a data center. And these are devices that are designed, in my opinion, Juniper probably disagree with me, aren't designed for data center of any scale. They're designed for enterprise closets, enterprise kind of server rooms, that kind of stuff. And they're just nice and simple. They're kind of a network black box. The challenge with those is that they are a black box and you can't see down the links. You can't really see what you're using and what's doing what behind the scenes, and why things fall down aren't always clear. So one of the first things we did is we actually started bringing on some folks who had experience across multiple vendors, but also had experience scaling and some of the more shady aspects of networking, like when Macs start colliding and what happens when you start running out of ARP cache and stuff like that on boxes. And this isn't rocket science stuff, but it's not stuff that I had time to run down. So the very first problem we found out is that our EX core, if you will, in this stack actually was out of ARP capacity. And that was just a nightmare, because anybody who's ever ran into IP collisions or ARP collisions knows that it can just get wonky to track down. Well, when you've got 12,000 plus devices on a network and you have 8,000 ARP entries in your table, you kind of hit this point where things just randomly quit working. And then we also found out that some things had been put in place. People didn't know why, but we were just randomly clearing ARP tables in the background. Nobody knew why. Nobody could really explain it to us. It just, that was the decision. So it was compounding issues to the fact that not only would entire chunks of our infrastructure suddenly quit working, and if you know networking, you know that's because their ARP cache was timing out and other things were filling in those gaps as they came online, then you just were randomly clearing the ARP table. So the issue would suddenly go away. And then, you know, another chunk of things suddenly wouldn't work. So it was just a total ghost in the machine to us. And that's frightening when you're dealing with a company that is VC backed and you're growing rapidly and you're just trying to understand how to make it scalable. When you can't track that ghost of the machine, then it's just chaos. So we went from there and started kind of running those things down. And at that point, we realized what it was, and it was ARP cache issue, and we just didn't have enough ARP entries capable in our core. So that's the big issue we ran into. We also ran into issues that we just have platforms from a systems perspective getting away from the network that are all over the place. We have things that were bought on eBay 5 years ago. I should also go back and point out that, you know, we had gray market gear on the network side that had been kind of mixed with gray market and real market stuff. And that just gets to be complex when you're dealing with maintenance and all that. And then we also had the challenge that we had a massive implementation of Cisco UCS here. And I'll upset some people in saying this, but Cisco UCS is not a great platform for scale out infrastructures like ours, infrastructures that are growing through the tens of thousands of VMs and on. And I sold the platform and liked the platform in the past. But on top of the fact it doesn't scale well to what we do, it was deployed very, very wrong here. No shared storage, not using service profiles correctly. And instead of having fabrics that were synced, our fabrics are all over the place. So I think we have six or eight fabrics, and not one of them, even in a fabric pair, is even close to the other one. So it's just a nightmare. And again, these aren't things that people did intentionally. It's just kind of, they did what they did to survive, and we're left with a boat that has a bunch of holes plugged in it, and we're making that boat stable and floatable and ocean capable again.
Yeah, sure. You talk about some gray market gear. I mean, first, for those that aren't familiar with the term, can you explain gray market? But then my real question is, when do you decide, all right, new equipment is expensive, but you need it? You know, when is it okay to go unsupported, gray market, or man, I just need to get total retail to super supported gear for this?
Yeah, again, this is also where I'm going to piss off vendors. So I've done both. Like Ethan said, we worked together, and we worked together in a startup that didn't have a ton of funding. So let's go back to what is gray market, real market gear. Gray market gear is gear that has probably come out of somebody's data center or somebody's overgrown, or somebody, God forbid, paid NFR for and then didn't need it anymore. So they threw out on eBay, or they threw it to a third party reseller. And there are some legitimate gray market resellers out there that kind of have Cisco's blessing to rebadge and refurbish this stuff and resell it. But even then, it's kind of hard to get it licensed, and there's a bunch of wonky stuff. And the same thing goes for Juniper and Arista and everybody. None of these vendors like gray market because it takes money directly out of their funnels and their quarters and puts it into a reseller's pocket or a gray market dealer's pocket. Right. And this is different than black market. We need to be clear. Black markets, you know, this stuff's falling off the back of trucks in Mexico and China and somehow making it onto Alibaba and stuff like that for a quarter of the price. It's not that, but there are massive price savings when you go gray market because this stuff's kind of past its operational life for the people who originally bought it and the investment's already there. So I bought $10,000 core class switches for $2,000 and $3,000 before on the gray market and implemented those, and also ran into real significant issues with those when the version that I bot has iOS 15 or whatever on it. You have to go license the software on it with Cisco, and that gets dicey, or with Juniper or with whoever else. That's the differentiation there between, you know, normal market for sale and then gray market. As far as when you buy it, the vendors will tell you never. As far as when you buy it, labs are usually a great place. That's where most of us get our home labs, is gray market type stuff. When to run it in production, that's a business decision that every business has to make for themselves. What are the risks? And every business runs into these questions as they grow and as they try to make decisions. Not going to ever advocate that you don't license things, but businesses make decisions all the time, or at least have in the past, not to license Windows or not to license whatever. You should never do it because, one, it's illegal, and two, it's dangerous to your business. You're not going to get the support you need, and you're not going to get the, you're potentially running the risk of not even getting the support, but getting sued and your business just going away. And having dealt with a startup who had been stuck in a similar situation to that in the past, not Sauce Labs, let's be clear. You know, I've done the BSA lawsuit thing, and it's a pain, and it's expensive no matter how you look at it, and it's dangerous to the business. So that's kind of my take on when you do it, which is should be never, but it's a business decision.
How do you determine, Josh, what should be done in the cloud versus what has to be done locally? Because I think when you and I were chatting, there was a cloud aspect to the Sauce Labs business as well.
Yeah, so we are a private cloud. That's the way to look at our business and what we do. We build out hardware that other people use. And this is the whole weird thing that we talk about when we talk about cloud, and this is where people get upset when you say cloud is just somebody else's computer. That's the reality. There's always metal behind it. There's always data centers. There's always routers and switches. Just a matter of who's running it. And for what we're doing is we're building out a scale out testing cloud, not a general compute cloud like AWS or GCE, but actually a cloud that has a specific purpose. We call it a platform as a service because of what we do. There are some of the things we do. We definitely run components of our product in AWS. We run object stores there. So we capture data that clients would like us to test in video and in screenshots so they can replay those tests and they can kind of see what happened in a test, make sure their clicks are going in the right places and stuff like that. And that happens in encrypted Amazon vaults on S3 for us. So things like that make a lot of sense. There's other aspects of our business that probably will or won't make sense over time. We just acquired a company out of Germany, TestObject. They run quite a bit of their platform actually in the cloud, and that's cool. And it actually gives us flexibility. Where it doesn't make sense, though, is when you start getting into those kind of scale-out structures. Anybody who knows anything about AWS and GCE, they have billing models that are per hour, but there's also a spin-up. So the second you spin up an instance, whether it's small or large, you're billed for an hour. So you're billed for 2 cents immediately or 5 cents immediately or whatever your rate is that you've negotiated or that you're locked in at. So when you're standing up millions of instances a day of Windows servers or Linux servers or OS X instances, then that's not really optimal because those costs stack very, very quickly. And suddenly the cost of managing and scaling out a data center for a year can be covered in 2 or 3 months. So you don't actually get that benefit of, oh, it's somebody else's infrastructure and it's cheaper. You also have the issue that even if you can make it cheaper, we've worked with some folks like PacketNet to do some modeling. PacketNet is really close to our per cost per VM annually for year one. And then you jump into year two, and instead of having gear that you're depreciating over year two through five, or, you know, until the gear dies or is unusable, whatever that time frame is for you, you don't get to depreciate it because every year that same usage rate is being rebuilt. So year one, you might break even, but year two, you go 100% underwater. Year three, you go 200% underwater, and so on and so forth and on and on and on. This is something that we've actually watched Amazon start addressing, and they've got reserved instances. Matter of fact, I just got a call from my Amazon account manager the other day saying, hey, we've actually been looking at ways to optimize your business for you. Let's have a conversation about it. So they're actually getting really smart, especially as some of these other scale folks who have used their platforms, these cloud platforms in the last 5-6 years, you know, built their businesses, whether it's Dropbox or whoever else, realize we can't continue to scale at these rates. So Amazon and GCE are starting to understand that risk and starting to try to find ways to optimize those businesses for folks. So the decision really, again, is a business. What is your business? How does your business operate? Is your business a long-lived service or a short-lived service? If it's a short-lived service, is it a short-lived service that's short-lived a million times a day, or is it a short-lived service that is a true service that spins up for 5 minutes a day and spins down? It really becomes a financial model about how your business wants to grow and what the modeling is for cost to clients and so on. Because at the end of the day, somebody always pays for CPU, RAM, cooling, and physical floor print. Somebody always pays.
There's an interesting demarcation point between putting together stuff that bootstraps your company and, oh crap, we need some legit gear to support growth. So as you scale out and begin to grow, keep an eyeball on the infrastructure decisions that were made in the past, because those pain points can be avoided or maybe triaged in a better way than that deep, hairy troubleshooting. Because no one designed a startup with like, oh, enterprise scale out in mind. Typically, that's like phase two.
Yeah. So my point and my takeaway is related to this. I've walked into a number of environments over the years where I was hired as something between a fireman and a doctor, just like, help, everything's terrible. And you just go in and go, what were these people thinking? I'm the hero coming in to save them from all the stupid they've been subjected to over the last... Reality is never really like that, because companies grow beyond their original vision, beyond the original amount of money maybe they had to work with. And so the infrastructure that a lot of times you inherit, if you walk in there supposed to make things better, a lot of what they've got is just they piecemealed it together as best as they could over time. It doesn't mean that there was a clueless designer there. There may have been, but that's not necessarily what that means. I mean, I think most of the time, what you've got is someone doing the best they could with what they had to work with. They had a certain amount of budget. They had a limited amount of equipment. And what's there is, yeah, we did what we could. And so then you've got to go on from there, which is a good point that Josh made about the environment he had walked into. And the same with me with some of the environments that I walked into.
I will always picture you as a fireman, Dr. Ethan.
DataNauts listeners, Ethan here. I'm sure you're aware that DDoS attacks are a normal part of life. You've probably been hit by one, or you're going to be at some point in the future, and our sponsor, Encapsula, can protect you from those DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service, while also offering bot protection, website security, load balancing, a content distribution network, and it is all one easy-to-use service. And if you're missing what the point of this is, the big idea is to put Encapsula in front of your website so that your website is protected. Your website will continue to deliver content even when bad things are happening. The thing here is that Encapsula is seeing all of your traffic anyway, so they're going to block that bad stuff, which is maybe the most important thing. But since they're seeing it all, they're going to accelerate that good stuff too. The bad stuff goes away, the good stuff gets even better. And if you think DDoS protection is no big deal, I personally think it's a really big deal. It's not hard these days for someone to build or even rent someone's command and control network and then unleash terror on your website, keeping your web down, offline. Encapsula protects you from this sort of an attack because they have their own massive network, 3 terabit per second network with 30 data centers housing their packet scrubbers. And I love this little detail. They codenamed their packet scrubbers Behemoth. Behemoth scrubbers can handle 500 million packets per second, and all of that put together means that putting Encapsula in front of your website means that you can withstand a DDoS attack. So to add Encapsula's capabilities to your website, visit encapsula.com/packetpushers and use promo code DataNauts to get a 30-day free trial. One more time, that's encapsula.com/packetpushers. And use promo code DataNauts to get a 30-day free trial.
So it sounds like your major initiative to start off, Josh, was really going from the chaos to the order. I think that could be a difficult journey, even just define what is order, you know, from your pair of eyeballs there. What is order supposed to look like? And how do you plan for that appropriately, especially in the case of Sauce Labs?
So yeah, when I was first hired, when I went through the interview process, everybody continued to just say things like, operations is a black box and we need it to not be. So order from the first perspective was about cracking open that black box and helping people understand what the challenges were, start being very upfront about what they were and what the risks of fixing it versus the reward of fixing some of those things are. So that's phase one. And the way you do that is, like you take over any network or like you take over any system, you've got to dig into the configs. You've got to dig into the metrics that have been collected. In our case, we were using some SaaS services to collect network metrics. Those network metrics were not optimal and were expensive and were not able to really show us what we wanted. So we stood up a Libre NMS instance for an NMS just right off the bat. That was like goal one. So we could get real-time, high-order metrics to see what was going on. And that helped a little bit. It helped us point out some bottlenecks. It helped us start getting some config backups and some just kind of baseline. So it's all about baselining and seeing where you're at and then kind of looking where the goals are. The next stage was actually attacking those things, and order for us meant stability. When I came on, there were fires raging. We had clients who were frustrated about our reliability and they didn't understand why we weren't being as reliable as they needed us to be. And we didn't understand as well. And it's worth mentioning that we're a sticky service. Once people start using us, they usually don't retool out of us easily. They'd rather stick around for us to fix a problem than to go back out because they've structured all their test architecture around us and done customization around us. And it's a very sticky service. Stability was the key thing, and reliability, and making sure that our clients were actually getting what they needed out of us so that they could do deploys every day and test against those deploys and make sure that we are available for them.
Josh, I want to qualify one thing here. So as you say, stability, did that come down from the business heads? In other words, in your conversation with the business folks, they are saying this is what we need, or was this something that you kind of, you know, inferred?
It's why I was hired. So the business not only told us, yes, stability. Matter of fact, we had our kickoff pretty much the day I started for the year. And the mandate there was pretty much hard stop on everything. We are going to slow everything down. We're going to go to a reliability model for the next 2 months. The whole company did it. Devs did it. Ops did it. We started reliability channels in Slack. If you were going to even look weird at a server, you went into reliability and told everybody, kind of became an all hands on deck to monitor the metrics. And just in case anything you did cascaded, because so many things at that point in time in the environment cascaded, if not into a failure, then to a degradation of service. It was a core business goal, but it was also exactly why I was hired, which was to take all these kind of ghosts in the system that people didn't know what they were, find them, execute them, and move on to stable platforms.
My point being, you had to talk to the business, and it was a partnership's too strong of a word, but I mean, there's a direct connection between you, the technical people, and the business side to move the infrastructure ahead to where it needed to be.
Absolutely. And this is weird because I don't like the term DevOps. It's not a bad term in and of itself, but this was the first kind of DevOps-y thing. We talked a lot about it, but that we really did, which was everybody talking a lot and being very transparent about, okay, ops has this problem. If devs do this, you will break things. So the ARP thing was a good example. Previous to us coming in and finding the ARP cache issue, devs could spin up as many boxes as they wanted in their dev environment. We function on a big slash 16 because that's just how the environment grew out of somebody's garage at one point. So when you've got a big slash 16, that one IP change can have a cascading effect around the entire environment, and things like that were happening. So we actually had to start interacting with each other so both sides knew the impacts that they were having on the other side. And then back to the business, it was, yeah, where our clients are being affected. So I was talking to salespeople and I was talking to the CEO, and inevitably, as we started fixing this, I started talking to the CFO a lot about the money we were spending and why we were spending it.
I'm hearing so many things that I'm thinking, yeah, I remember all of those, especially this last 16. I remember coming in and thinking, why is this all slash 16? Like, that's got to be a gigantic collision domain and then hit similar issues. Well, as far as that goes, is that as simple as, you know, you had an L2 problem, you've got a slash 16 problem. Are those simply things like, oh, we're just going to go to a different underlay or just put in more L3? Like, is that simple, complicated? You know, what's the reality of fixing stuff like that?
Well, it depends. I've been in environments where it's really simple, where it's a business environment and it's kind of more of an enterprise model. And the applications are, you know, off the shelf, Microsoft servers and stuff like that. They have to route that kind of stuff and you fix it. This environment's a little bit more challenging. We didn't have core L2 requirements to the application, but we had a lot of tooling that was tied to that. So when a new system would be provisioned, we actually had, if it was this type of box, if it was going to be a build environment, it got this address space in the /16. If it was a dev box, it got this address in the /16. And there was just very hard decisions made about tooling. I should say not hard, but static decisions made about tooling that tied us to that /16, even though the applications could talk and route and do all the other things. In our case, it's not like we could just say, okay, let's start breaking this up into VLANs and taking outages. No, we would have broke our tooling. And as any business knows, especially a software business, you can't just say shut it down and quit deploying features while you fix everything. That'd be awesome, but very few businesses have that luxury. So you can't just throw out all the tooling and start from scratch. You don't have the time. You don't have the cycles. It's an incremental thing over time that you've got to start fixing it over time. So what we did here, I'm pretty bullish when it comes to dealing with vendors. I approached two key vendors who we were looking at for our new data center top of rack architecture that we'd be building out in the data center we built in Las Vegas middle of this last year, and said, whoever gives me a core class routing platform that will allow me to get all of my routing off of this itty bitty little Juniper architecture and actually punt all my L3 stuff up to a big core class box will win my first pod. And man, when you give vendors that type of incentive, it's kind of crazy what they'll do with prices. I won't say the vendor's name because it's not fair to them. I learned this at the VAR when I used to work at VARs, but I ended up taking about $250,000 core environment and getting it for about $20,000 because they knew there was a long tail to it. That's good for the business because that's not a long-term piece of gear I'll use. Sure, it'll get used in a lab or maybe we'll add them as super spines or something later, but it's not something we needed right then for anything other than to just get pressure off of this black box Juniper platform we had and start, one, getting some visibility and, two, getting some stability out of it. So that's how we have solved it temporarily. We are also moving into architectures where we've had to just work with the devs, and because each operational development team for us owns their own tooling stack. So for us, that stack is mostly Ansible, but they own it and how their own platform deploys and how they scale their Ansible stuff. So it's a matter of, again, refactoring over time to say, okay, now it doesn't rely strictly on the /16. And we've also done things like generate labs that look like what Las Vegas looks like now, which is full L3 from the server to the top of the rack, L3 spine leaf using BGP, and in our next data center in California, because we'll be launching with four pods instead of just the one pod we currently have in Vegas, we'll be doing that with super spines as well. And it's just all L3. So we've given the developers and our operations folks an actual lab that looks like that so they can go in there and break it and figure out how that actually looks to their own business use case.
So there's stopgap things that you did to fix the production issues, but then with new stuff, you know, new pods, you've got a whole new infrastructure that ideally everything would be. But as you said, I mean, everything's in flight. You can't just like stop for a month and change everything the way you want it to be and then go back. You've got to do the best you can with what you've got.
Yep. You got to keep the wheels on while you're rebuilding the car on the roll. It's very interesting methodology. And it's something, Ethan and you and I dealt with this when we were at the Telemed together where we worked. There was a lot of broken things there. And sure, you could take a network outage here and there, but that business was a high availability service. And our business is a high availability service at Sauce as well. And when you're dealing with services, like I said, that people count on, whether it's life and death or whether it's just, you know, you got 500 people who can't do their jobs without your service up, you've got to find ways to keep it rolling and keep it functional and keep it stable while you're also moving to the next gen. And we've watched a lot of people across the industry do this. Some of them just say, we're going to do a Skunkworks and we're going to build a 2.0. We're just going to launch a brand new 2.0 and then migrate clients. That's one way to do it. It's expensive, a lot of overhead. It allows you to get a lot of the old broken things out. But then there's also all the cost involved in it. The methodology we're taking right now is we're doing it incrementally. And we're rolling out, I guess, 2.0 features within the platform as we roll out services.
Automating and scheduling workloads. I know that's part of it. You've kind of hinted around it, talk about how your developers deploy their apps somewhat. Do you guys have experience with OpenStack and Kubernetes? And do you have any comments there?
Oh, I got lots of comments there. Our experience is directly tied to Kubernetes right now. And before I go any further, I'm going to say that I really support Kubernetes and what it does. How we've done it has been a little odd. OpenStack's one we've looked at a whole lot because, and I'll start there because I put a lot of thought and a lot of time behind OpenStack as far as planning. And we actually hired an OpenStack person on the ops team to help us get there. When we first came on board, there was a lot of friction between operations and developers and trust. And you've just got to little by little work over that. And when I first came in, my understanding was that that was the ability to provision hardware, to allocate networking resources, and to kind of do all that opsy stuff without talking to ops in a very AWS or GCE or cloud type fashion. Give me an API. I don't want to talk to somebody or put a ticket in. That's where OpenStack was really shiny and very interesting for us. And we started putting a lot of thought and planning into it. What came out, though, was the fact that our devs aren't really worried about the friction right now that the ticket or that stuff causes, because our ops team is actually pretty responsive at this point in time. And we've worked really hard to get that trust factor up and get the response times down. So we've kind of moved away from that because the issue is more about actually having the hardware to provision for them. And that's a company and planning issue we've been working through for the last year. So it didn't make a lot of sense for us to go down the path of OpenStack and add complexity while we were also trying to, like I said, keep the wheels on and move to the next stage. Kubernetes, though, is really powerful. You guys have talked about it. I've listened to some of your podcasts and a lot of other people's podcasts, even when I was ramping up on it. And long and short, it gives you the ability to say this service is always up and running, or X instances of this service are always up and running. And one of our groups tied to our command and control operation had a great idea to start segmenting their service into microservices and put it on Kubernetes. We had a lot of concerns about this, especially because we had this big broken /16 network, and we had a lot of scaling things that we were trying to work through. And at the end of the day, they really felt that there was more advantage to them running in the broken environment and figuring out how to do the stuff later in the new environments right, as opposed to hold up their development. And they moved forward with that. And our concern was that in a /16, everything works. In a /16, there is no routing. There is no weirdness between environments. Sure, we have ACLs, IP tables, EB tables, that kind of stuff that segments the environments for security. But from a just talk to things, there's no complexity. If you know anything about Kubernetes and Docker, it's all effectively NAT. And Kubernetes especially has a core basis of saying everything's L2. And there's a ways around that by using overlays, whether it's Calico or Flannel. There's a lot of different overlays that if you're working on this, you need to research. But you don't have to worry about those in a /16. Things just scream and yell at each other and they work. As soon as you move those to other architectures, so spine leaf and stuff like that, you have to seriously start looking at overlays and what the implications are. And in our case, just to be very blunt, the developers got their stuff working. It had some of the returns. We actually saw some real benefits, like dynamic rollbacks. A deploy didn't go the way they expected, so almost instantaneously they rolled back. And that was cool. It's not a feature we had necessarily had before. But then as we started moving into how do we put that service in Las Vegas, the answer came up from the devs. Well, we want you guys to just extend the L2 from the current /16 to the top of the rack to the new data center. And I went, whoa, whoa, whoa.
You think you want that?
Right then and there, I stopped it. And I said, we're done. And I actually had to go back to dev management and to the management team and say, guys, I'm not against this. I should be very clear. I support this all along, other than the fact that I don't think we have the clear understanding of what the things we're asking for and doing actually mean to the business. We've stopped that. And subsequently, we have a new plan that we're in the process of working out and how to do scalable data centers and how we're going to launch that coming into 2017. So our entire infrastructure can actually live across multiple data centers, not just two, not just three, not just the US, but also in Europe and wherever else. We have a plan for that. And with that actually comes a very functional structured plan for Kubernetes, for an actual overlay, and for what services have to be synced between the data centers and what services honestly don't. There's zero reason that our clouds have to talk to each other between it. Our databases and our key value stores and our message buses, sure, they have to. So it's a matter of getting to the right point and getting to the right architecture. And again, understanding what overlay is going to work optimally with, you know, our BGP spine leaf architecture and with the backbone we're building, because we're also building out a full carrier grade backbone, not as large as Twitter or Facebook or anything like that. But we're building this platform to scale. We're building scale architectures now that we may not need, that are cost efficient and can grow for what our goals are for the future.
Mm-hmm.
One of the points Josh made got me thinking here that what devs want to do can impact ops, and what operations wants to do can impact developers, because there's processes that both teams depend on. What one does affects the other. We hear DevOps, and there's a technical meaning for it, et cetera, but maybe DevOps, really where it starts, is about communication and awareness between those groups, in addition to the specific technical practices that we all get into and get all excited about. What was your takeaway, Chris?
I like hearing the obvious, you can't shut down and start fixing your environment. You have to keep the car rolling while at the same time changing the tires. You have to right the ship, but at the same time, the idea of, like, let's collaborate and work with the entirety of IT, you know, the devs and the ops and whatnot, to fix things without causing an issue with the tools and the workflows. Like, yeah, don't just, well, it's fixed now, it's your problem. You know, don't throw it back across the wall, fix it. I also like throw the jump ball up and see what vendor really wants your business for long term. Like, hey, we want some cheap stuff for our first one. That could be a good way to bootstrap things, show that it works, and then scale it using that kind of pod nomenclature down the road.
As we pause the Datanauts infrastructure rocket for just a moment, let's talk about the conference the Packet Pushers are going to be at in May 2017, Interop ITX, and they are a sponsor of today's show. Interop ITX is where tech pros go to get objective, full-stack IT education, and it takes place May 15th through 19th at the MGM in Las Vegas. You can join me, Ethan Banks, along with Greg Farrow and Drew Conry Murray of the Packet Pushers, where we will be putting on the Future of Networking Summit, and that is a two-day session where we're going to take a deep dive into next-generation developments in the WAN, data center networking, network operations, software-defined security, all the things that we think are emerging over the next 1, 5, and 10 years. Register for Interop ITX and attend other hands-on workshops like The Future of Data, Container Crash Course, Dark Reading's Cybersecurity Summit, and the Open Source IT Summit. The event's conference tracks focus on security, DevOps, cloud, infrastructure, data and analytics, all the technologies you need for a successful full-stack IT strategy. If you're looking to accelerate your career, there's also plenty of sessions on leadership and professional development. Plus, check out over 100 vendors at Interop ITX's Business Hall, where you'll have the opportunity to check out what leading and emerging tech vendors have to offer. Join us at Interop ITX this coming May and use promo code PacketPushers when you register, and you'll receive a 20% discount. We want to see you in Vegas, so go on up to interopitx.com and reserve your spot today. Josh, we've talked about some of the chaos you walked into, the things that you've done to bring order to that chaos, and let's look at where things are now. My first question for you, have you gotten to the right staffing levels yet?
Oh, staffing's tough. So when I first came in, there were effectively, I want to say, three of us, maybe four of us, including the data center guys. They had just gone through a big purge prior to me, where the VP of operations had come in and said, there are people taking 4-hour lunches and there are people who really don't have the vision for the company. And that's just part of it. That's just part of growth like anything else. It doesn't mean they're bad people, but it means they're not right to be on the bus at that point in time. So you let them off the bus and you bring new people on. So that's kind of when I stepped on. So we had a lot of hiring to do. We had a couple in the can, and then I had a couple people who, unbeknownst to me at the time, had decided they were going to follow me out of my previous gig and come over, which was awesome, but kind of a shock. So the answer is we're pretty close to the right staffing levels right now. I mentioned DevOps earlier and how it's kind of a weird word. What you find once you actually get into a mode and people start trusting you in an organization, especially as a big dev software company starts trusting its ops group, is you start getting them saying, oh, well, you guys know what you're talking about. So instead of us trying to field network questions or systems questions or us trying to engage with sales or customer support, we really need to start dedicating people from the ops organization into handling that stuff because they're the best people to do it. So right as I, you know, got my right staffing, we had people come along and start throwing sales and support stuff at me, which we luckily in that case actually had a couple people in the can who we had passed on because they were more customer focused people. I'm going to throw a name out here. Steve Rosen was one of my candidates for my senior network engineer. And anybody on Twitter in this kind of space that we're talking about probably has ran across Steve at some point. Steve is awesome, but Steve had a real deep customer facing focus and not some of the service provider stuff we were looking. So all of a sudden when our sales and support people needed that network interface to start taking calls and start interacting with ops, I immediately called Steve up and said, sorry about round one, round two, you're here. Let's go. And we got Steve on really quick. And 60% of Steve's time is focused on customer support and DevOps support as far as helping the dev teams with technical issues around networking and systems. And the other part of it is the other 40% or so roughly is him doing actual network tasks and him doing network planning with the rest of the network team. So that is interesting because that has happened in the network team. That has happened with our systems guys. And we also have what we call a DevOps engineer, a guy who's actually tying APIs together. He's a developer on the ops team who's actually tying IPAM APIs together with Ubuntu MAS deployment APIs and actually creating really functional tooling for us. And he's gotten pulled away a little bit too. So yes, we kind of got the right staffing. And then as soon as we kind of get things under control and have staffing that's balanced for where we are, the business comes along and says, we need to scale dramatically. We're truly entering that hockey stick mode. And oh, by the way, we just acquired Test Object and now we have to spin up a DC in Germany and migrate them to a DC in Germany and spin up a SaaS instance in Germany. So the reality is I'm now looking at probably doubling the staff in the next year to 18 months to actually cover that. Because especially when you're running, you know, 3-4 data centers, there's a hands issue. And I already mentioned that we're dealing with real devices. You know, you carry your iPhone around in your pocket and, you know, it's kind of a seamless device. You charge it, it does its job, you get updates, you move on. That's not how it works when you stack 60 or 70 or 100 of these things in a 3U case. They overheat. People's apps can lock them up. They can do all sorts of things and they're very high touch. Same thing applies to Mac devices. We use thousands of Mac minis due to licensing requirements with Apple right now. And they're not a data center enterprise product. They're high touch. When they don't work, you go touch them and hook a keyboard up to them and do that kind of stuff. And we're figuring out more and more functional ways of dealing with that, but there's just staffing and body stuff tied to it. And then, like I said, as we go to Europe, you've got to stand up a team there. You've got to have a network engineer who isn't 20 hours of flights away if something goes really wrong in the network there. And this goes back to what I said earlier. A cloud is somebody's hardware. Somebody always pays the price in bodies and heating and cooling and everything. Somebody always does.
I like when you talk about having a developer kind of working on the ops team. Reminds me of a sheep coming over wearing wolves clothing, like reverse. It's pretty cool. So I know like the idea of making the progress on the network is a project. It's like a never-ending project, but you certainly have milestones and phases or whatnot. What's the state of that? I mean, it sounds earlier you talked about a lot of the things that you were doing to rectify the issues and the software that you're using to orchestrate. Is that kind of like, all right, it's all good. We're just maintenance mode now, or?
We are not maintenance mode. We will not be caretaker mode for a while. And quite honestly, caretaker mode is boring. The interesting stuff is solving problems. I'm here because there's a problem to solve, not because somebody wanted me to throw my feet up on a desk and read a paper. The state of that, and I'm going to dance around this a little bit. You know, we're an operating business. We're a business that I don't want to divulge too much about. But where we are is we have solved the layer 3 issues like we've talked about. Our core network is stable. When you're running this non-data center class gear as data centers, you run into other issues. So case in point, the Juniper gear we're using, it does Mac hashing. So it doesn't actually have enough memory to just hold mass Mac tables. So we're occasionally running into what we're calling hash collisions. So the same Macs are hitting each other, and that gives us a little bit of a ghost in the machine. And we know how to solve these things. We have the hardware in place. Like I said, vendor X gave us big cores that could have got us off this. But there are significant challenges to that. We've taken a couple 6-hour outages, which are painful for our customers because we're in this continuous delivery mode with our clients. So they count on us. So 6 hours, even on a weekend, can really impact their business. But the reality is we had to go to the business and say, to fix the next problem, so X, Y, and Z problems, we have to do like serious issues. This isn't a 6-hour window. This is more like a 10 or 15 hour window. And the business is like, whoa, that's nuclear. That's nuclear to our clients. So we've had to make some decisions and say, okay, we know we're going to be out of this legacy data center probably by the end of 2017 or the most of our stuff. There will be some things that live there. We're trying to figure out what to do with it, but we will be in at least 2 or 3 other data centers with large portions of our business by then. And the more you start taking out of these environments and you start reducing the footprint in this big /16 suboptimal DC, the problems start going away, right? Because no more hash collisions, no more ARP issues, no more, you know, flooding of the /16 L2 just because there's so many clients on it. So a lot of stuff goes away as you go down. So that's kind of where we are. I had mentioned earlier that we already have a data center in Vegas that's already holding a significant portion of our cloud. Like I said, a big part of my business is how to scale the company, not only get it stable. So we put a very significant portion of our cloud, our actual production cloud, in Vegas this year. And it's operational as of about a month and a half ago. And we're continuing to put more and more services in there. Because again, it's an iterative process. How do you get away from this? You either start from scratch or you iterate, and we're iterating.
Well, yeah, that's actually a good question, Josh. I mean, as that new infrastructure stands up and is available to you, I mean, how do you actually move? You just kind of said pieces at a time, but is there okay, here's a segment of the infrastructure that we can pick up and we can move over here. Is it tidy like that?
It's kind of tidy like that. It's not as simple as that. Again, there's things I don't want to go too far into because I feel like they might expose a little too much of us. But the reality is that our cloud architecture components of it, we're pretty much move over and talk to our command and control network. And parts of our command and control network are distributed, so they can be moved over, but not all of our command and control network. I call it our secret sauce because, like I said, we run on a platform that is open source, Selenium and Appium, and there's a grid concept for both of those. But there are things we have done that are different than what's in the open source space that make us special and allow us to do this, operate this as a public cloud. So components of that are easy to move. Other components have to be iterated upon. And we have a plan going into 2017 that we're just now, as a development and operational management team, starting to talk to the teams about, that we will 100% move out of the current /16 by the end of 2017. And we will have the entire platform running in multiple data centers. I can't go into the details of it. I wish I could. We haven't even discussed this deeply inside of our teams now, but that's where we are. We've gotten the infrastructure to a point where we can start having those conversations about, okay, here are the next big steps. They're going to hurt. They're not going to hurt the business, but they're going to hurt us as contributors because there's going to be a lot of work into them. But at the end of 2017, we have a much more flexible, much more scalable platform based on the fact that we've gotten out of that broken environment. We're not worried about the lingering ghosts. I mentioned earlier things like UCS. We've moved off of that, not because necessarily it's a horrible system. It's a horrible system for what we do, but we're moving to commodity. We're moving to these spine leaf architectures that are not a bunch of nerd knobs. They're BGP and ISIS. We're moving to Supermicro servers that are not proprietary chassis. They're 1U boxes that, you know, we can kind of treat them as cattle. If this quarter they give us good prices, great. If the next quarter HP gives us good prices. But we're getting away from all this proprietary nerd knob crap. And that is a big part of how we're winning and how we're able to get to this next step of, okay, now let's get away from the old proprietary stuff, because we've created these stable structures that it's worthwhile to spend the effort for 6 or 8 months to say we're done with the old, here's the new. It is incremental, though. It is not a just move everything or a sauce 2.0. It's an incremental move, and it's going to be a lot of effort.
Are you still having to make decisions about whether you guys build your own software in-house versus use something already built? It seems like that was an issue.
That's actually a really cool question. So again, no current bad decisions in most companies were made out of stupidity or poor planning. It's just kind of how things did. So 8 years ago, almost 9 years ago, I guess now, when SaaS started, a lot of the tooling we have now doesn't exist, you know? Containers weren't a thing. VMs were the hotness. So back then, the platform kind of ran on VMware for a while. Now we're totally a KVM shop. You know, now we're moving to look at things like Docker. So yeah, we are still building a lot of our stuff inside. That's just the necessity of a custom base. A lot of our core functions, again, I hate to use the term because it sounds really cliche with our name, but the secret sauce of our company is our custom software and how we do things. However, 8 years ago, they did really cool things. Like, they effectively built a product that was their own key value store. And that was built in-house because no other really solid key value stores were out in the wild yet. And we'll probably over time migrate some of that things to Redis and stuff that has a community behind it that we can use. And we use Redis now, but again, some of the things we built. We also effectively built a product that was its own cloud manager that was like an OpenStack or like a vSphere. We kind of built our own lightweight version of that did our own thing, because we didn't have mature OpenStack. And even with mature open stack now, I've listened to enough of your guys' podcasts and read enough stuff that if you're really going to do interesting custom stuff, you still have to have developers to do that. And I don't think we're really ready to just jump on the train of let's hire, you know, 5 or 6 OpenStack developers to support our stuff because our stuff works. But the things that will work, so message buses, key value stores, container management systems like Kubernetes, we are definitely looking to the community and looking for things that are more supportable and have some longer teeth and more community behind them than some of the stuff on our side right now. I should also say, a lot of this probably sounds like I came in and my team came in and we just kind of started doing things. We've actually, and I can't name the name of the companies, but we've been working with a couple scale outs and even a mass scale and talking to friends who I have there in the community saying, are we doing the right things? You guys are where we were 5 years ago. Are we doing it right? And if they say no, then we rethink it. And usually they've said yes, because we've hired some folks who have come out of scale out environments. And it was interesting. I listened to your guys' serverless talk with Brian Gracely. He said, you know, he's never had a problem reaching out to people and saying, what are you doing? Or help me out and understand this. And I think you echoed that, Ethan. We've had a lot of support from the community where the community is like, yeah, you guys are on the right path. Keep it up and call us if you need us. And that's powerful in this. If you're not doing that in the community, then you're leaving a lot of value on the table.
I definitely like the idea of reach out, phone a friend when it comes to community. Because why not? That's the reason it's there. And so let's pretend we're phoning you. And the question is, hey, outsourcing to the cloud, using infrastructure as a service, using serverless or functions as a service. We had a show on that recently. What's your take on getting rid of stuff in your data centers? You've got to manage, you know, 4+ of them already. And just saying, this is someone else's problem. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm using serverless.
I'll start with, I covered a little bit of this earlier. I think it really comes down to business model. I think it really depends on how your business works. There's clearly some businesses, especially in the startup space, that really benefit from the ecosystems and cloud that are out there. I watched some of the AWS reInvent stuff the other day after the event. And it was interesting because they started talking a lot about the cloud and scale out and Elastic and blah, blah, blah. And that's great. It's right for the right business. But right on the tail end of that, their CTO was also like, and for big environments, this is great. So you can spin up a new application or you can test something very quickly. He kind of almost acknowledged the fact that this isn't for every business, but please stick with us because we still add benefit to you. And I totally believe that. While we're internalizing a lot of our things, I'm advocating that we have an Elastic model that allows us to burst capacity into the cloud. That allows you to level out your capital spends as long as that burst doesn't take you past what a capital spend would be. That's the real challenge. I could keep talking on that, but it really comes down to business model and cash. Then we start talking about serverless. I'm trying to keep an open mind. I've listened to all of your guys' stuff on serverless. I've read a bunch on serverless in prep for this because I knew this was going to be part of the discussion. At the end of the day, I can't get past what I have said already. Somebody always pays for power, cooling, CPU, processor space. Somebody always pays for it. I haven't fully wrapped my idea around the function as a service that you guys were talking with Brian. You had a lot of kind of base examples, but I haven't necessarily seen anybody say this is an actual use case, especially when you're talking about an internal ops team, because there's still networking and communications and stuff that has to happen for a closed infrastructure, like you were talking about PowerShell and that kind of stuff. I get it, but I kind of don't. Where I have a bigger issue is when people are just like, oh, we're just going to write glue code and the whole world's just glue code between APIs anymore. So I've got an entire set of tabs open in Chrome that I've been looking at on this. And it's just like, okay, let's look at this in the consumer space. We've had IFFT for how long? IFFT's about glue code. And that works because that is just taking APIs or taking, you know, services that are out there and tying them together. Then you look at Zapier, and Zapier has done the same thing in the kind of cloud enterprise space and even in the enterprise space, taking enterprise tools and cloud tools and tying them together without a whole lot of effort just by hooking APIs together. I think that stuff's great. I think it's a totally different thing, though, when you start building a business and you start just using glue code to build a business. What happens if you're suddenly successful? So that AWS or GCE spend or whatever your spend was is pretty cheap. Say you're paying $2,000-$3,000 a month for a reasonably successful business. What happens if suddenly you're now on Hacker News and your freemium service now gets 10,000 more hits than you did, and suddenly you're paying $1 million that month? Can your business sustain that, or do you go away instantly? So those are the real challenges when I look at things like serverless. People can't just forget how businesses run. People can't forget how to do operations. You look at the best people who are kind of doing serverless stuff. You look at like the Reddit guys. The Reddit guys don't have network people on their team. That's pretty cool because they don't need it. They don't need that overhead, but they don't ignore operations. They understand how this stuff still works. They still do monitoring and metricing. They still do bandwidth monitoring to understand what they're doing and where their business use case is. I'm kind of coming around on the fact that I'm not just, I think it's a stupid term. I just don't think it's fair. I think when we start calling things, you know, no ops and serverless and DevOps, I think when we just start putting these kind of key terms on, people who are just getting started in here start missing out on the fact that there's a bigger picture. And if they're not paying attention to that bigger picture, their really cool product might not exist next week because they can't pay their credit card bill.
Hmm. Well, Josh, we've talked a lot about SaaS Labs, what you guys are doing over there, the challenges you're facing, and put some real-world teeth into a lot of the unicorns and buttercups that that sometimes comes out on a podcast like this where it's awesome, just install this and everything will be fine. And it's never that simple. And so this was a great show to talk about real-world challenges and how you're dealing with a lot of what you're facing in your IT environment, a lot of which has to do with emerging technology. Josh, are you social? Do people, can people follow you on Twitter? Do you blog? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I do. So I am on Twitter as Josh O'Brien 77. So find me kind of at staticnat.com. I used to blog a lot and now it's less, but it's there. There's a lot of interesting stuff and hopefully I can get back into it over time, but that's where you can find me.
Thanks a lot for taking the time to record with the Data Knots Show. And that is it for today's edition of the Data Knots Podcast. You can follow the show by subscribing on iTunes or on Twitter at datanauts_show. And for more of our Data Knots shows about infrastructure engineering, head on over to packetpushers.net. You will discover dozens more shows covering many of the sorts of challenges we discussed today, including what Kubernetes is all about, cloud operations, full stack engineering, containers, storage, network design, and everything else to do with making IT work at your organization. Until then, may your server lights blink, your encryption remain unbroken, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Ha 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 ha!